Alright. So I know he's not going to be here. God knows about everybody else. Matthew is here, and Riley is here, and Deshaun is here. Christ is here. Samantha is here. And why the heck did I give you a dot up there? I must not have been paying attention. Busra is here. So Busra, don't be absent on March 19th. Don't be absent on March 19th.
Why?
Because I've already filled in that you're here on that day.
Okay.
They got I could leave a little early today. I have an appointment.
Yeah.
Training.
Yeah. All right. So we know what was going on in the Eastern Front. It was completely lopsided. The Austrians were kind of running around in circles. The Russians were falling back, but the Germans were driving forward, creating that scenario. But eventually, once the Germans boosted their focus, they were able to begin making a more uniform line, allowing the Austrians to advance and driving the Russians almost out of modern Poland. In the West, things were completely different. Whereas the Austrians and the Germans were not getting along, the Allies in the West, there was no division. The Brits and the French began working well, at least over the winter of 1914, effectively together. Why? Well, very simply. Both Field Marshal John French, commander of the BEC, and Joseph Joffre, commander of French forces, they pretty much were of one mind. It was simple. We got to drive the Germans first out of France, then out of Belgium. Simple, simple, easy. And, according to some of the accounts I've read, these two seemingly got along. I won't exactly say they were best friends, but there was no disdain. But here's the thing. Obviously, the reasons behind this objective were different. Whereas the French wanted, sorry, I thought there was another click coming. I'll just leave that up there. Whereas the French wanted to drive the Germans out, the Brits viewed it more as a calculated strategy. French, similar to Hindenburg, believed that the war would not be won or lost in the West. But rather French, as in General French, not meaning to confuse you, General French believed that the war would be won or lost in the East. So the Brits wanted to beef up, strengthen the West to cause the Germans to continue to have to send more men to the West, thus allowing Russia, possibly, the opportunity to either knock out Austria or Germany or both. This is one of the reasons why the British decided to abandon their initial pre-war strategy, where they were not going to build up men and material on the continent, but instead they were going to focus on the sea, to a newer strategy of sending more and more and more boys across the English Channel. Numbers reached so high that the BEF was able to actually divide into two separate army groups. Plus, they also brought in some territorial divisions. It was in the winter of 1914-15 when the first Indian troops appeared. They actually brought men from India. They also began bringing over some Canadians as well. And by increasing their strength, it would actually give the Brits a chance to attack, to go on the offensive, rather than simply holding the line. But where? Where along this 600-mile-long border, this frontier that was made, where would they attack? Well, an early plan involved attacking the Belgian coast. Germany had control of Belgium. They figured if they could use the Royal Navy, they could basically attack the coastline, use their artillery to drive the Germans back, allowing for a beachhead, similar to what happened in World War II when the Allies landed in Normandy. But the Admiralty warned that the German artillery could potentially pulverize the transportation ships. And we all know how much it costs to build a ship, right? So ironically, the Royal Navy, the Admiralty, backed out of this idea because they didn't want to actually use the Navy for naval purposes. Another idea developed.
I didn't realize this clip was up here.
So instead of striking from up here, another idea came, well, why don't we try to make a southern front? What if we, for instance, use the Navy and sail into the Adriatic and bomb the Austro-Hungarian coastline? Or what if we land troops in Greece? Or what if we utilize Bulgaria? At the time, Greece and Bulgaria were neutral. Maybe if we land in those countries and march north, we could help the Serbs out and penetrate Austria from the underbelly. Which, of course, would trigger the Austrians to have to pull their troops from attacking the Russians. Which, again, the goal is to cause a strike that's going to be detrimental to the well-being of the Germans and the Austrians. But the problem was the entire Austrian Navy, as big as it was all here. So if you were going to sail into the Adriatic, you're literally sailing into where the enemy's Navy is, which could result in loss of ships and thus loss of money. And, as I said, Greece, neutral. Bulgaria, neutral. A neutral nation cannot allow a combatant army to go through their territory. So the ideas were there, but neither of them worked. So they decided that maybe we'll skip on this one. So instead, they just looked at the map and said, all right, where are we going to attack? Where are we going to attack? Again, 600 miles of line from the canal to Switzerland. Where on this should we go? Plus, it's not even just a matter of figuring out where you want to attack. It's how are you going to break through? How are you going to break through? The Germans had stationed along the frontier seven armies. Each army controlled a sector that was connected by railroads. So if you attack, say, here, the German armies could shift their men. So even if you got through the trenches, it's only going to be a matter of time before the Germans can basically shut the door down. Plus, do they have the firepower to break the lines in a way that would allow for the attack? So, the discussion began revolving upon, instead of trying to find a place where we could break through, where's a place that we can inflict the most casualties? Because if we can kill lots of them, Maybe that will break the morale. Or even better, maybe that will force them to have to pull troops from the east to support the west, which would allow the Russians to get an advantage. Questions? So ultimately, what they decided to do is they decided to focus on infrastructure. The Allied command took a look at the major railroad lines in Belgium that the Germans had taken over. There were three main railroad lines which went through the country. Germany, since it took control of this red solid line right here, had quickly began creating trunk lines. So what they would do is they would bring in material from Germany, put it on a train, and they basically had the ability to reinforce men. They had the ability to bring in ammunition, medical supply, foods. So French started trying to devise the possibility of finding a weak point in the lines to break the railroad lines. If they could sever a point of the line, then everything west of that breakpoint could not be resupplied. And that would be the way they could turn the front. At least that's what they believed. Because again, the goal is to end the static warfare, which set in after the race to the sea, and make it mobile again. So, in working together, the Allies decided the best attack would be a joint attack. English and French troops would work simultaneously, striking at the German lines from two separate points, hoping to stretch the Germans thin, allowing for that breakthrough, and again, return to fluidity. The British, with some French troops, would engage in a joint operation in Flanders. The same battlefields where in the fall they did the race to the sea. In the Artois region. At the same time, the French would attack from the Champagne region, down there. They believed that by engaging in these two simultaneous strikes, that they had the ability to turn the German forces, to cause a retreat, and potentially disrupt the flow of supplies. Because you had the ability to break the railroad lines in two spots. So if the Brits are successful, suddenly that's going to open up the rest of Flanders. But if the Brits aren't successful, and the French are, then that's going to sever all of the lines feeding almost the entire front. So in early spring, they decided to attack. Now, FYI, have any of you ever heard of warring season? Unlike modern warfare, which takes place 365 days of the year, all the way up until the 20th century, you generally did not attack in the winter. Because what happens in the winter?
It's cold.
It gets cold, it snows, it's complicated. There's no food growing, things like that. So traditionally, when the battle season began, it was always on the first warm breezes of spring. Now, when the attack began, it was ferocious. It was ferocious. They got fresh troops, they got resupplied, and they went to town. They were all in. Massive artillery bombardments, charges. But what happens when, like, you play sports and you just run and run and run and run and run and run as fast as you can?
You're tired.
Yeah. You get spent. So unfortunately, while they attacked with ferocity, unfortunately, as we're going to see, these first two major battles were just kind of like, huh! Short, sweet, and then the Germans would drive them back. Why? Well, the French and the British believed that once they attacked, they would penetrate the lines and everyone would be retreating or advancing or charging. The one thing that they did not predict is that the Germans would try to stay in their trenches instead of charging out and attacking, but rather they fought from static positions. Now, why was this possible? Well, they didn't have the artillery reserves. They were empty in the fall, and by early spring, they hadn't had a chance to build up their munitions. So once they launched the strikes, they weren't able to penetrate. And the Germans could simply stay in their trenches with their machine guns and go bop, 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 and mow them down. And by the way, this would remain true until the United States entered. One of the reasons why the Western Front lasted 4 years was that the ability to charge was based on what could be produced. And if you ran out of munitions, you could not attack. So you could throw as many millions of men as you want, but if the enemy has an equal amount of bullets, the enemy's going to win. Questions? All right. Now the French would attempt to attack first. They would launch a minor offensive in February. This first Battle of Champagne was meant to gauge the strength of the enemy. But no significant gains were made. And whenever the French charged across no man's land, the result was death. It doesn't take much of a mind's eye to imagine thousands of men running across an open field at guys that are dug into positions with machine guns. It doesn't take much of an imagination to understand or appreciate the results. In the end, these thrusts, and that's all they were like little strokes. So we'll attack a little bit over here, and then we'll attack a little bit over here, and then we'll go down a little, we'll randomly attack down here. Everywhere they tried, they were met with casualties. And the death rate during the first Battle of Champagne was 2 to 1. 2 French soldiers died for every German. They didn't get a single inch of territory. Every single thrust was called off, and the survivors retreated back to their pre-attack positions. In March, the Brits would attempt attack near Neuve-Chapelle.
right there, right where the dot is. I actually zoomed in on the map to find it. This was part of the agreement.
See if we can strike at the Germans in the south. See if we can strike at the Germans in the north. Well, the Battle of Neuve Chapelle is historically significant because this is the first battle in which a strategy developed by British General Douglas Haig was implemented. And by the way, this would be the strategy that would be used all the way until 1918. It's called a set piece attack.
Here's how it works. You use your aeroplanes, and they fly over the enemy trenches, taking pictures, trying to find places where it did not look like they had an overabundance or concentration of soldiers. Then, once you determine that location, you then bring in your artillery. Haig moved 342 guns into the region and had them open fire in a continuous bombardment. Why? Well, the Germans, once they dug in, protected their lines with barbed wire. So the primary reason why they used the artillery was to blast big holes in the barbed wire. And if you hit some of the trenches, great. You're trying to literally rip holes in the line.
Haig ordered his artillery to continue to fire continuously, nonstop, for 35 minutes. Boom, 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 boom. Keep in mind, some of these guns you can get off 15 rounds per minute. He would have had them go further, but unfortunately he ran out of shells. Then, in those holes in the line, the Brits were to charge out of their trenches, race across no man's land, and enter into the enemy trenches. Of course, the one thing that the British didn't anticipate was during the winter, the Germans had actually made bunkers. They had dug in. So when the artillery shells are coming down, they're not all dying. So just at the point as the British get over the lines and enter the trenches, the Germans come out. And they clash. Unfortunately, the Brits didn't have enough reserves. They sent all they had. They had no more. So just at the point as it looked like the Germans, who managed to quickly get their reserves out to resupport or plug up the holes, just to the point where it looked like everything was going to end, the Brits had a retreat. In the battle of 2 hours, the Brits suffered 13,000 casualties, including 4,000 Indians. The Germans suffered 9,000 casualties. This was the template. This was the test. And this is what makes this battle significant. Oh, General Douglas Haig, he's there. I didn't realize he was coming up like that. Haig, based on the results, look, we managed to break the barbed wire. We ripped holes in the line. We managed to cause some destruction to the German trenches. We actually were able to rip a hole. This made Haig convinced, all the way until 1918, that a breakthrough was possible. But it would just take more. It would take more. He figured if he had enough guns, and if he had enough shells, and he had enough men, he could actually do it. There's the explanation for why the death rates for the next 3 years would be so high. You just need more, more, more. So you're going to bring in more guns, you're going to fire more shells, you're going to cause more death. And then you're going to send more men across, only to meet with the same reaction by the Germans, and thus more Brits are going to die. And then everyone's going to have to retreat, but then we'll try it again. We'll try it again. What's the definition of insanity?
Doing things over and over again, expecting the same result.
Yeah. Yeah. Now here's the problem. Haig looked at it from an entire operational perspective. But you know the one thing he never added into his calculations? Why were the Germans not guarding the trenches? Well, because 35 minutes, artillery shells ran down, and when the shells started falling, what did they do? They went into the bunkers. Haig anticipated the Germans would just sit there in their trenches and wait to get blown it up. So the one thing that he didn't take into account was the only reason why the Brits were able to cross no man's land to begin with was because of the bombardment. The moment the bombardment stopped, the Germans repositioned. And thus the Brits walked into death.
It was insane. But again, I'm going to keep saying this for the rest of the semester. This was the strategy that Haig was absolutely convinced would result in a win. If I just had that 10 more guns, and I had just 1,000 more rounds, and I had 10,000 more men, just that much more, I could win. Now, after the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle, the Germans would follow up with their only attack of the year. Falkenhayn was more content to keep his men safe in the trenches rather than trying to spearhead attack. But after the battle in Neuve-Chapelle, Falkenhayn believed that maybe the Brits had weakened themselves, and so we're going to try again in Ypres. Hitler was not at the Second Battle of Ypres. By this point, Hitler was repositioned. He was down closer to Verdun. He was down closer to this point in the line. Now, similar is to the race to the sea, the Second Battle of Ypres, generally speaking, are just four minor battles that were all interconnected. But it would last for about a month. Now, the interesting thing was is that Falkenhayn, unlike French, who was convinced that, you know, we could make a difference, or Haig, who believed we could actually rupture the lines, in planning and unleashing the Battle of Ypres, the goal was actually not to break through. But the bizarre thing was, the goal was to show that the Germans were still strong in the West. So basically, the plan was is to basically disrupt the status quo. Although, truth be told, it's like I do in class sometimes. You know, watch this hand, watch this hand, watch this hand. This is the distraction because you're paying attention to this hand. You're not watching my other hand. What Falkenhayn was actually doing, as we already covered, he was causing the distraction in the West while slowly moving more men and material to the East. Because you're fighting a two-front war, and that's the only way you can do it. But unlike any of the other battles that we've talked about, the Second Battle of Ypres was very, very different. During this battle, both sides unleashed secret weapons, believing that technology could
cause the war to shift.
For the Germans, it was here that they unleashed their new form of gas. Recognizing that tear gas, bromethyl anxite, I think that's what it was,
like they used in Russia, was not effective enough. At the Second Battle of Ypres, they would deploy chlorine gas.
And I like talking about chlorine because you all know what it smells like. Because you've all been in pools, I'm assuming. Falkenhayn authorized the use of this weapon to be a diversionary attack.
Chlorine
was heavier in the air than tear gas. Tear gas froze and turned to droplets and hit the ground, or quickly dissipated with the wind. But chlorine hangs in the air, even if there is wind.
But when you get close to Flanders in the channel, the wind is always consistently sweeping up behind where the Germans were
and pushing the air over to where the Brits were. So this was the perfect battleground to deploy this weapon. And
it was meant to be smelled. As we all know, chlorine kind of smells like a combination of sweet like pineapple, but bitter like pepper.
And if we inhale too much of it, it makes us cough.
The German military staff used a system that was devised by Nobel Prize winner Fritz Haber.
Simply put, the troops would take cylinders, 90-pound cylinders, bring them up to the front trenches, and connect the cylinders with hoses that would be held in place by sandbags. And then you would open up the tanks.
And the gas would, you can see if you look close at the different strikes, each one of those points, that's a different hose unleashing the cloud. This is an actual picture that was taken in the air by a German pilot flying over the Battle of Second Ypres.
As the liquid chlorine touched the air, it turned into the cloud. And of course, it spread. On April 22nd, at about 5 p.m., they released 171 tons of chlorine gas along a four-mile front near the village of Gravenstaffel, which was 5 miles north of Ypres. So there's a map of it. This first star is Gravenstaffel.
Here's Ypres right here. There's the inner city. That's where the fortress is. And there is Gravenstaffel right there. So the Germans are all positioned. They're also up on a high hill. They unleash the clouds and it comes down and descends upon the village.
Now, that location was not planned because of who was there, but coincidentally, that position was actually held by territorial troops. They were Moroccans and they were Algerians. When the gas reached their positions, the officers assumed it was just smoke. But soon, when inhaling, the soldiers began complaining of chest pains and a burning sensation in their throat.
At some point, they realized that this was not something you wanted to breathe in. So soldiers began throwing their rifles down and fleeing.
Now, by the way, it took out 3,000 men, 1,200 of which ended up dying from inhaling this gas.
Now, ironically, as the gaff spread, the German troops followed the cloud.
They had primitive gas masks on, made out of cotton pads, which were soaked in a sodium solution, which kind of masked the smell.
And as a result, the Germans were simply able to march into town, take over the positions.
They took the guns, the artillery, everything that the territorial troops dropped. They dug in and claimed the village. The next day, they did it again, near the town of St. Julian.
Because what they were trying to do is they were trying to carve out the bulge. They're trying to push the line forward, believing that maybe they could get it down to Ypres.
Here were Canadian troops.
But because of what had taken place the day before, word had come down the line.
And so what the Canadians began doing was they began, I think I have a picture of it. There are the Canadians right there.
What they began doing was taking handkerchiefs and peeing on them, believing that the urine would counteract the gas.
Did it work?
For some, yeah.
That's crazy.
But not all.
What is the gas actually do to the body?
If you inhale enough of it, what it does is it causes your lungs to begin turning into jelly. And if you inhale enough of it, it's almost like drowning. It's you die with the sensation of drowning.
But you can't breathe.
Right. Yep. So long story short, you don't want to do it. Well, they tried. Overall, they were insufficient. But it was enough that the Canadians didn't quite fall over to the rate that what had happened the day before. But unlike at Grevenstaffel, at San Julian, the Germans actually refused to obey orders. They didn't want to advance like their cohorts did down the line because they didn't want to walk into the gas cloud, because their primitive coverings did not work. And these are some of the men that actually inhale. Look, he's got a respirator, a primitive respirator, to try to get fresh air into his lungs. So the Germans realized what they had wasn't enough protection, so we're not going to run into it. Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Other questions? Well, when the Germans delayed, that gave the Canadians and the British troops a chance to reposition, and they managed to actually drive the Germans back. Also, during this battle, another terror weapon was utilized for the first time on the Western Front. The Brits had used the first mine. You can see the dot down on the line where it was used. The mine itself was detonated on July 19th, 1915, near the village of Hooge. Engineers dug a trench, a tunnel, 20 feet below the surface, and they dug all the way to the German lines. They then packed the position with 3,500 pounds of TNT. At 7 p.m., just after the Germans had settled down for dinner, they detonated the mine. It ripped... I thought I had a picture of it. I guess I don't. It actually ripped a crater 120 feet wide, 20 feet deep. The moment the mine went boom, the Brits then charged the lines. Now, ironically, the Germans were caught completely off guard. Because what did the Brits not do? They didn't use their artillery first. But even though the Brits were able to get in and take over the German positions, within 3 days, the Germans reinforced behind the lines and managed to drive the Brits back. Well, in the retaliation for the use of the mines, the Germans then subsequently deployed another terror weapon. The Kein Flammenwerfer, which in English means a flamethrower. This was invented in 1909 and was used to clear our agricultural lands. But it was then expanded, and the idea was to kind of use it how the Byzantines used it, to keep Constantinople safe, to use as a defensive weapon. So the idea would be Road Warrior. You know, you'd have towers that had the flamethrowers on it, and when the enemies advanced through your walls, you just burn them to death. Well, when World War I erupted, the decision was to basically separate the system from the forts by creating a backpack that contained two cylinders that could be worn by one guy while another guy had the launcher. So the first flamethrowers were a two-man operation team. One guy had the two tanks, which resulted in the proper mixture, and the other guy had the lance with the igniting device. So as the propellant was pumped through the tube, it hit the igniting device, and it spewed forth this massive flame.
So if you shoot the guy with the backpack, you get two kills.
Right, but notice how they did it. Mm. What they did is they had it was about a 6-foot section of tube. So the guy with the backpack stayed back, and the guy with the lance came forward. But they didn't work individually. They were deployed in teams of 40 pairs. So just like the wall of smoke, I found another picture, but I forgot to put it in. You had the 40 guys working in tandem. You had a massive wall of flame. And so what they would do is they would creep close to the enemy positions and open it up. So imagine you're sitting there in your trench playing cards or whatever, and next thing you know, flame is pouring in.
Terrifying. Terrifying. And by the way, that's the way they were described. I'm just looking at my notes. A report that came back from to the German high command was that the French, who first had the flamethrowers used on them, were terrified. They would actually run out of their trenches into open areas, which would then allow the German snipers to take them out.
But the Brits, to their credit, they did not panic.
So when the flame jets, because what they ended up doing is they ended up coming close to the British lines at night under the cover of darkness. And just as the sun started coming up, they opened up the flames. Well, while the flames were terrifying, the Brits didn't run. And when it seemingly had the flamethrowers run out of fuel and they began pulling back, that's when their snipers aimed up and started taking out the German guys trying to crawl back to their trenches. Terror weapons, but not enough. Neither gas, nor mine, nor flamethrowers. It's not enough to break the lines. But it's an interesting spin because all of these are deployed at the same battle. The end result, Second Battle of Ypres, Germany lost 35,000 men casualties. The Brits suffered 60,000 casualties. The French suffered 22,000 casualties. And the Canadians would suffer 6. Now, FYI, Ypres would see the most battles out of the entire Western Front. In total, there would be three more battles. The first happened in 1914, the second happened in 1915, the third would happen in 1916, the fourth would happen in 1917, and the fifth would happen in 1918. Hitler, by the way, was at the fifth battle, and that's where he suffered mustard gas. He would be blinded and he would be knocked out of the war. War in all its grandness. All right. Now, in the end, for all the death, the Germans were able to enjoy a little success, as I've demonstrated here. They weren't able to completely compact the bulge, but they did manage to move their position down closer to the city. But they never would get there. So all that death, do I have the distance? I thought I put the distance in there. It was laughable. I don't. I think it was something like 20 meters. Imagine that, close to 100,000 casualties for 20 meters of ground. But that's the nature of the Western Front. Questions? All right, what about the French? Well, at the same time, the Germans were striking up here at Ypres. Joffre decided, well, now's the time for a French strike in the Artois region. Artois is just a little south of Neuve-Chapelle. So, Joffre was convinced, well, if he strikes a little further south, then that would ease pressure up against Ypres, force the Germans to have to reposition men, and possibly result in a breakthrough. I say that wicked sarcastically. By the way, bless you. The first battle of Artois, that was one of the battles of the race to the sea. The second battle would be more significant. It was launched on May 9th and it would last until June 18th. Now, ironically, one of the reasons why Germany was not able to close the bulge was because of this battle. And this battle was a stupid place to launch an attack. Because, there we go. The Germans had the high ground. Here is the Artois region. Right here. Here is the Vimini Ridge. Here is the Mastery Ridge. The Germans had entrenchments up on these high hills. So in order to strike them, you had to run across a field, like we can see out the window, right into the flat open spaces. Dumb, 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 dumb. Now, why did Joffre pick this point? Well, because the German occupied the high ground, their ability to reposition those or reinforce those positions was challenging. So he figured this would be a good place to strike. But before he did so, he brought in unprecedented firepower. He moved in 1,200 guns. Initially brought in 700,000 artillery shells. In total, in this one battle, both sides combined would fire over 2 million shells at one another. Along a 5-mile front, there was nothing but devastation. And they did actually manage to drive the Germans back about 2 miles. But, like much of the battles of World War I,
particularly the early battles, when they ran out of rounds, they decided to end the attack. All of these shells were fired by 70 guns. That's it. 70 guns filed that stack. So multiply that by the entirety of the 1,200 guns plus the few hundred that the Germans had. You're literally talking a mountain of brass. Which, of course, would be collected, sent back to the factories, and repurposed. But by the end of this operation, which lasted a month, again, at the same time the Battle of the Second Ypres is going on, the counts were high. The Germans were able to not only regain their positions, but the French would suffer over 100,000 casualties in 1 month. The Brits would suffer over 32,000 casualties in 1 month. And the Germans would suffer over 73,000 casualties. Now,
after the Battle of Artois, after the failures of Neuville-Chapeau, after the failures of Champagne, after the devastation of Ypres and Artois,
the Allied commanders sat down and they decided to analyze what had taken place throughout the spring of 1915. A report was drafted by French General Philippe Pétain, who will assume control after the removal of Joffre. Now, by the way, if you've heard of Philippe Pétain, he was the commander-in-chief of French forces during the Blitzkrieg. It was Pétain who would surrender France to Hitler. In the very same railway car, at the very same location that the Germans signed the armistice on November 11th, 1918. So, he is coming to prominence. Well, he analyzed what had taken place at all these battles. And he argued, one, like Haig, a breakthrough was possible. But, two, only if momentum could be sustained. So it's not just a matter of blowing up the lines. You got to keep the men charging.
So how do you do it? Well, here's point three of the report.
Reserve troops should be held at bay until the front line wave reaches the enemy. So the moment your troops touch the enemy lines, that's when you bring your reserve troops up. To basically keep the pressure moving forward.
Four, attack in open country. Don't attack where there's cities. Don't attack where there's mountains. Attack where there's open country.
So that way you can avoid obstacles like buildings and trees and rocks. And lastly, five, the attack should be on a broad front. So unlike Champagne, unlike Neuville-Chapelle, which were narrow targeted strikes, you try opening up an assault on 10, 15 miles. Because if you open it up on such a broad front, there may be pockets of resistance, but you can flood the zone. Run the gaps, to use football terminology.
So, like Haig, who was absolutely convinced this would be the strategy to win, the French started thinking the same damn thing.
The problem is in order to tango, both partners have to be dancing together. Whereas the British were convinced we could break through. The French were convinced we could break through. The Germans did the exact opposite.
They engaged in a renewed focus on the one things that allow them to plug the holes. And by early summer 1915, the Germans literally begin bringing in engineers, contractors, construction companies, and they start turning their wooden barriers to keep the dirt from coming in, and they begin bringing in concrete.
Because the Germans were not trying to break through. The Germans were trying to hold the territory. So when the French and the British exhausted themselves, they would have the advantage in negotiations. They also brought in barbed wire.
50 yards. Again, if you've seen 1917, you know what I'm talking about. 50 yards in front of their trenches would be nothing but a sea, a jungle of barbed wire.
And of course, there are many pictures that are going to start coming up as we start talking about the dead, of human beings thinking that the barbed wire was severed, running only to become ensnared.
And once you're tangled up in barbed wire,
hell, even me in my blind stage, I could take you out. Shooting a stationary target's easy. Questions? All right. Whereas in early 1915, the French and the British were largely on the same page, by the summer of 1915, cracks started appearing.
Cracks started appearing. Not only between
the British and the French, but also within their governments. Some leaders, military and political, argued similar to what Joffre and Haig began arguing.
So like the Germans, who were divided, these guys were also divided. Joffre and Haig believed that they could break the Germans by winning on the Western Front. And if they could break the Germans on the Western Front, that would allow the Russians to roll on the Eastern Front. And you could effectively knock Germany out. So we're going to amass all of our strength, all of our capability, to constantly bombard the Germans.
But, particularly in Paris and in London, there were many political figures.
One of them being the vice... What was his position? The vice admiral. No, it's the vice commander of the Admiralty. Winston Churchill.
Yeah, vice commander of the Admiralty.
Yeah.
He and many others began saying, no, the way to break the Germans would be to create a southern flank. Again, focus on the Adriatic. Focus on launching a land campaign in the Balkans. Or hell, even seeing if you could strike at Russia by knocking out the Turks. If they could put pressure on the Ottoman Empire, that would cause Germany to have to reposition strength on three fronts.
And inevitably, that elastic is going to snap.
So, if they could create this soft underbelly and other imagined weak points, they could achieve victory. Now, FYI, both the Easterners and the Westerners would continue to argue all the way up until 1918. But it's interesting that the same division is impacting the French, the British, and the Germans. Questions? We're almost done for the day. I don't want to run out of stuff next class. All right, so how are you going to achieve a victory in the West? Well, I said, you're going to continue to pour men in. And where the French were limited, they only had so many men of fighting age, although they were drawing in some of their colonists, the Brits in particular began significantly expanding the headcount in the Western Front. Soon, they were bringing in territorial troops by the tens of thousands. These came from wherever there were British colonies. Additionally, I mean, you had Sikh soldiers down here, you had Aussies down here, you had the Canadians. They also created new armies because they began drafting people at home. So they brought in Brits, they brought in Welsh, they brought in Scots. Actually, I don't think I have any of the units in kilts. Scots actually used to take the battlefield wearing kilts. Ultimately, these new units would result in the largest military force in the entire history of the British Empire. They never had as many troops under the banner at one time. And who made this decision? Well, one of the most famous political leaders in England at the time, Secretary of War, Lord Horatio Herbert Kitchener. Kitchener's face literally would be plastered across England on their recruitment posters. He was their Uncle Sam. But unlike Uncle Sam, who actually was believed to be a food merchant, Lord Kitchener was actually a war hero. It was Kitchener who would ultimately achieve victory in the Boer Wars, of course, at a high cost. And he did so by unleashing atrocities. If you know anything about the Boer Wars, the Boers were defeated when Kitchener unleashed scorched earth. He ordered the complete destruction of homes and farms and livestock. And he intentionally attacked civilian populations to break the military fighting capacity. So it was Kitchener who decided to see if we could bring this type of, well, effort and somehow start hitting the British population. Sorry, the German population. Well, as a result of this swell, the Brits were able to take over more and more of the Western Front, beginning just north of Ypres and coming all the way down to the Somme region. All stacked with Brits. Of course, they were buttressing the Belgians, who were allowed to basically have a position, a little bit of Belgium that was still free. And it would be in this new position that the Westerners would get another chance. During September, the Allies believed that they now had enough men
and enough ammunition to once again attack
the German lines, believing that they could punch through. What they decided to do is almost identical to what they did in the spring, except do it at the same time. Because they learned when the French launched their attack at Artois,
that the Germans had a little difficulty fighting two battles at the same time.
So in September they did just that.
They launched the third battle of Artois and simultaneously the second battle of Champagne.
English Canadians and some French in the north and just French in the south. They believed by putting pressure on two fronts, they could achieve victory. But a huge mistake was made. When the plans were formulated, Joffre demanded that the British focus their efforts on the town / small city of Loos. Joffre wanted them to attack Loos because at Loos there was access to the La Bassée Canal. The canal network, massive interconnected canals, rivers, that basically stretched from La Bassée and could make their way all the way up by pushing things on water to the Belgian lines itself. So Joffre believed that if you could take this, you basically could begin shutting all this down. Because you could move men quicker, easier. But the problem was, is the sector was a mining sector. So, in the village area, there were huge heaps of slag. Basically pig iron. They would take it out, it was junk, it was liquefied, they would dump it, and then it would harden. So you had these mounds of metal that the Germans could hide behind. It also had towers, colliery towers, trains. Oh, I thought I had the pictures up there. There we go. See, this is what it looked like.
You had a massive hill, because this was a dam, that held the waterway back. But all in here was pocked with these mounds of metal, and you had high positions, and you had towers that the Germans could put snipers on, or observers. So in order to attack, and by the way, here is the German front line position, in order to get there, the Germans are going to see you coming.
And there's all these obstacles in the way. So Haig and French were outraged by this. They thought this was a stupid place to attack. They argued that you're literally going to run and you're going to trip over all this stuff. The Germans are just too well defended. Better to attack 10 miles north on the frontier. Plus, they did the same argument. We need more men, we need more ammunition to actually break through. But in something that would happen over and over again in Vietnam, for example, it was the politicians at home, not the commanders on the field, that would make the decisions. Kitchener would overrule his officers for the worst reasons of them all. Politics. Kitchener argued that even though we weren't ready for an attack, we had to attack now. Because politically, we had to show that we were helping the Russians. Because as we know, by the summer of 1915, the Russians are pulling back.
They're getting their butts handed to them. So kind of like if we didn't attack now, the Russians would want to bail, thinking they were abandoned. Plus, Kitchener actually said in his report to the king that if we attack now, even though we're not ready for it, that maybe some of the neutral nations, like USA, might be inclined to enjoin the war. USA being the United States of America. Unfortunately,
it wouldn't quite turn out the way Kitchener wanted. But that's not to say that the Battle of the Luce was not significant.
Because it definitely was. Definitely was. First, the Battle of the Luce is historic because it was the largest offensive in the war up to this point. The British were able to deploy in one battle 6 divisions, all charging across the frontier. 80,000 men. It's a lot of dudes. Second, the Brits would also develop methods for releasing chlorine. And it would be the first time the Brits used it in war. Now, one of the reasons why the Brits did it was because they knew they didn't have enough artillery to pound the Germans into submission. So this would be kind of in revenge for the Germans using it at Ypres. But the problem that the Brits had was their delivery method. Whereas the Germans had hoses and spread it across the lines, the Brits had cylinders that would simultaneously just release it in a plume. It wasn't directed. So where the Germans, and I put this on here for a reason, where the German release could be blown across the battlefield, all the Brits did was create this big cloud. And as I already told you, which way the winds blow. Instead of the cloud blowing across the Germans, what the Brits did is the cloud blew upon their own men. And instead of attacking, the men had to spend their time covering up, trying to survive the horror of death. Plus, because they were being released in a cloud, the Germans could figure out where they were. So there were actually documented instances of German artillery coming down and detonating British canisters, creating more death upon their own men. And this is the first time more protective coverings were used. The first primitive gas masks that involved not only mouth coverings, but also eyepieces. But the problem was is the gas masks were made out of flannel. So it was just cloth upon cloth upon cloth. Do you remember how comfortable wearing the face masks were during the COVIDs? Yeah, really comfortable, wasn't it?
Oh, no, it wasn't comfortable.
No, not at all. Well, imagine if it was nothing but like a sweatshirt that was on your face. Got hot. The eyepieces, like when I could not wear my glasses when the COVID was, because inevitably whenever I wear them, my glasses would fog up. Pissed me off more than anything. But the same thing happened to the Brits. So not only can they not breathe, but they can't see. So they're not going to charge across no man's land. And lastly, because I see we're out of time, it was also the first time in which the Brits would use aerial bombing. Aerial bombing. Now, both sides had been using planes like we covered since 1914, but because of the shortage of shells, the Royal Flying Corps, when they went up on recon sorties, would bring up a couple of shells with them.
And as they flew over the lines, they just begin dropping them on the unsuspecting Germans.
Well, by the Battle of Loos,
the Brits began mounting racks on their planes that they could bring up 100 pounds of shells, and at the right time, the pilot could pull a lever and they would drop them all.
Not quite carpet bombing.
But they began able to strike the German trenches from above. War was changing, that's for sure. And I realize we're out of time, and I'm not going to keep you any later.
We're going to come back. We'll just sum her up. Basically, long story short, the battle was disastrous. I'll give you the results. We'll see that Kushner, in the end, would blame, or Kitchener, rather, would blame French for this failure.
And then we'll see how the French didn't do so well at the Second Battle of Compiègne. Oh! And then we got to talk about the Italians, because by the end of 1915, Italy would join the war.
See you on Thursday.